What are the differences between public polling and internal polls?
There are many. You know, one of the biggest differences is really the methodology to start with. You know, how those polls are accomplished are pretty drastically different. Public polling tends to be done in a manner that can be completed quickly and cheaply. And so that might be an online poll, might be not the most representative. RDD, it's typically just one mode, and it's a mode that can get done quickly and inexpensively. And public polling is just, for that reason, a bit less reliable at the outset, right? Mm-hmm. Just because of the methodology. But that's okay because their purpose is also different. The audience consuming it is also different, and so forth.
Welcome to Crosstabs, the podcast that tries to explain how polls are designed and conducted, who they include, who they leave out, what they say, and what they don't say, so you can better navigate yet another most important election year in history. I'm your host, Farah Bostic, founder of The Difference Engine, a research-backed strategy studio helping leaders make big decisions. Each episode, we take a look at the art and science of polling. No takes, no spin, no predictions. This week, we're in conversation with Natalie Lupiani and Shannon Janine Curry of Benenson Strategy Group, a strategic consultancy that uses qualitative and quantitative research to, as they describe it, uncover the hidden architecture of opinion. Their firm has worked with the Obama 08 and 2012 campaigns, Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign, and continues to work with a variety of advocacy groups and candidates in addition to their corporate clients. They spoke with me the day after the Michigan primary and the week before Super Tuesday about how internal polls and research differ from public polling, what makes for high-quality issues research, and they offer some really solid advice on how to be a more discerning consumer of polls. Let's get into it.
I'm Natalie Lupiani. I'm a VP at BSG. Shannon and I have been working together off and on since 2014. I have been in the industry for the past 15 years. And before that, I was a weather forecaster in the Air Force. That is a story for another day.
A whole other kind of predictions.
I couldn't get the predictions out of my system. I had to keep going.
We went to trends now.
Right.
My name is Shannon Janine Curry. I'm a vice president at Benenson Strategy Group, which is a strategic research consultancy firm. I've been with the firm for about 10 years this week. Wow. So I guess I have some expertise in the world of polling. We use qualitative and quantitative research to uncover the hidden architecture of opinion, as we call it, which is really just understanding how people think and the decision-making frames that shape their attitudes and opinions. A lot of issue-based polling, and, you know, internal polling is meant for really strategic purposes. It's to really understand your target demographic. It's to fine-tune your messaging and the language that you're using, and ultimately to create a strategy. Ideally, you're using public polling to maybe disseminate internally for your team so that your communications team is using the same language that's on the website, that's using the same language that's in your campaign materials. It's really to find cohesion with a clear and strategic purpose.
One thing that came into mind just as you were talking about that is I was talking to a potential client yesterday who was sharing some examples of adjacent organizations' research that they've been able to share. And it's one of those things where it's like, okay, that's interesting. I could see a journalist writing a piece about it, but I couldn't tell you what anybody's supposed to do with that strategically, right? And sometimes that can be something like a, you know, a scatter chart that just has like a whole bunch of different demographic types on it. And it's like, okay, but so how do I craft a message? Where do I buy the media? What do I do next? Like all of those things are just sort of not illuminated by that. And I think the kind of strategic application of the research is the, to me, probably the most interesting distinction between what public polling is trying to do and what private polling is trying to do. The other example that comes to mind is, I guess, Echelon has now tested twice whether people correctly recognize RFK Jr. or think that he's his father. The people who are most supportive of him are the least likely to correctly identify him in a picture matchup. And I just thought, I mean, that's funny. It's got a little, you know, something to it. It's a little spicy. We can talk about that on a podcast or whatever. If I'm RFK Jr., what am I supposed to do about that? I think what I'd probably do is run lots of pictures of both me and my dad, like, you know, and just say, which he's already done. So like, so what? This was sort of my reaction to it. I think that kind of issue focus and strategic application is the thing that most public polling doesn't really show a path to that.
Exactly. And so speaking of a path, with the internal polls that are conducted for candidates, there is a trend line, right? We're not only looking at the in-the-moment results, we're looking at how the results have shifted over time. We're running polls kind of again and again among likely voters to understand how attitudes might be shifting. Is support growing or static or, you know, worst of all, right, is it shrinking? And so, you know, using the research in that way, it kind of changes the way that we need to view the results. You see sometimes on, you know, on news stations that they'll also show you kind of a trend, typically just the horse race or a support, you know, opposed trend. But what we don't typically see in that research in the public polling is research behind why that is. Why is that change happening? There's a lot of kind of pontification as to like why that's changing, a lot of theorizing on air as to why that's changing, but not anything really backed in the quantitative research. The drastic, you know, complete polar opposite of that is what we do, which is intended to understand why that that shift is taking place. If we can't identify in the polls themselves, then we undertake additional research to understand what's going on, what's driving the change, is it something that we need to address, et cetera.
So one question that brings up for me in thinking about that kind of time series trend line recurring research is, what's a good pace for that, that both doesn't start to introduce a lot of noise and reactivity, but allows you to have a real sense of how things are tracking and then be able to meaningfully respond to those changes or anticipate them or capitalize on them or mitigate them, depending on which way the indicators are going. How do you think about that kind of pacing and potential for noise?
So in most of our polls, whether they're public or internal, we ask an issues priority question. Like, what is the one thing that is top of mind that you are voting for, or is your kitchen table concern? If I ask that question and the battery, let's say it has the economy, inflation, foreign wars, immigration. If I ask that question last year, October, right after Roe v. Wade, abortion would be the number one issue. I just saw in a poll a few days ago, it's dropped down to maybe top eight. Right. Now, that's just because it's just not top of mind right now. We've got bigger fish to fry, other concerns that are keeping us up at night. But I'm sure as we get closer to the election and, you know, we lean into that as an issue that voters are going to be bringing to the ballot box, I'm sure we will watch it slowly tick back up because people are going to be hearing about it on a more frequent basis. So it's kind of understanding how the ebb and flow of that is going to move, how we figure out like where people are on that issue. And then you can kind of get an idea of when things happen in current events, how that issue priority starts to fluctuate.
Exactly. And in terms of a cadence for how often, how frequently do you dip in to the public opinion and try to figure out what's happening on those issues, you can have a wider space between polls the further you are from the election. And as you get closer to the election, the closer between your polls are. Because in this election cycle, especially, things change very quickly. I think like every election cycle, things move faster than the one before it, right? So it's just things are very, very dynamic. And so, you know, where earlier in the campaign, it may be, you know, monthly or every other month, the closer you get towards actually election day, you may be doing things on a biweekly basis. You may be like in the last few days before the election, be doing something quickly every day. It's really kind of dependent on how competitive your race is and what the specifics are with that campaign.
Even with Hillary in 2016, we knew when that last Comey report drops a few, like 2 weeks before Election Day, we kind of knew that that was the anchor that was going to get us. Because every time emails would come up into the conversation, she would take a number of point hits. So, like, it was a key indicator that the world was going to change.
Yeah. Yes. That is part of why I was asking about the kind of cadence and timing of things, is that there is this sort of sense of, like, gathering momentum the closer we get to the actual election. You know, kind of in any cycle, I think there's just more drama and buildup in the quadrennials, right? But there is this sense, and there's even a public narrative about it, the October surprise, right? Like that kind of idea that the last minute something is going to completely shift the result, that, you know, some people who are on the fence are going to get off the fence either to go the opposite way they were leaning or sit it out altogether or whatever. And I think that that is one of the things that I think about a lot, particularly right now as we're in this primary season, is especially when, you know, what the public gets to see typically is the public polling. And you look and say, well, okay, when did that poll go into the field? When was the last time that pollster was in the field in that place? And it's like, oh, it's been 6 months since they did a poll in that place. So we don't know anything about what happened between here and here. And then obviously you have other issues there. But I think that sort of timing thing is very interesting. Cool. I imagine this gets very expensive.
Could. It could. You just kind of hit the nail on the head. That's really a big part of the reason why you don't see that in more of the public sphere, because it's not something that the media outlets budget for to that extent. It's not in their best interest. They just don't need that level of precision. They don't need that level of accuracy and prediction. They don't have the ROI, right?
Yeah.
So what they're looking for, what public polling models are designed for, is really to kind of expand reach to the greatest extent possible, right? They're looking for clicks. They're looking for views. They're looking for attention.
Catchy headlines.
So they're looking for anything that can help them, you know, conduct their business, which is to get people to consume their media.
Yeah.
And so it's a tool in their tool belt. It's not, you know, without its own agenda. And so I think that's kind of important for people to just recognize as they're consuming that media that happens to mention polling or focus on polling. You know, there are a lot of, I think, questions people should ask themselves and of the poll, right, before they just blindly trust that it's the truth. And I know that you've touched on this in your prior episodes as well. And it just goes to show that's a real issue. It's a real thing that people need to be aware of.
All polls are not made equal.
That's right.
And most consumers and voters, they have no idea the difference. Yeah. And so they kind of blindly absorb, you know, because there is a major cable network or a major collegiate institution attached to it, assuming that they are getting bespoke, really targeted, focused research. Instead, it's, you know, more on the level of, you know, I'm not going to say a survey monkey. They use other things. But the attention to detail to make sure that they're creating a good quality survey is really what kind of differentiates it pretty quickly.
That's a really interesting component of it that I think kind of sits there in the background of my mind a lot and was not something I'd really consciously reckoned with until we spoke previously about, you know, the idea of you hear the phrase, it's a New York Times Siena College poll or it's a whoever Quinnipiac poll or whatever. And that does have this imprimatur of legitimacy because it is a university and there's sort of a presumption, more or less, that means it's got some sort of academic rigor to it or that it is in some way nonpartisan. And you pointed out something really interesting last time we talked, Natalie, which was, you know, these are being done by college students and they, you know, are by definition not particularly experienced pollsters and are using as inexpensive of tools as they possibly can because they and, you know, the New York Times do not have massive budgets for doing this work. It does seem like the New York Times is pouring a little more money into it over the last couple of cycles. But but I think that's a thing that I don't know people would pause to think about. It sort of surprised me when you said it, because I have my own feelings about like the Harvard Youth Survey, because I do a lot of stuff about, you know, young consumers. And I don't have high regard for that survey for a variety of reasons. But I hadn't really thought about it in the context of media plus university political polling before. Right. How did these partnerships come to be? Why bother? Why not just have your own internal polling organization like, you know, Fox News used to?
I mean, that's also expensive, right? Mm-hmm. You have to staff and pay for a lot of work to get done, whereas if you outsource it to a resource such as, you know, Siena or Quinnipiac, it is much more cost effective. Mm-hmm. It's great. I think it's wonderful that these institutions exist and are being utilized. I think it gives the students excellent experience that they can then leverage. But in terms of, is this expert level work? You can't just assume that. You have to go in kind of eyes wide open and really question, is this done properly? Do I have faith in it? Mm-hmm. You know, oftentimes there's a pretty clear limit to what any one of those polls can be considered or can do for you.
One of the other things that I think is a kind of difference between public polling and internal polling is that kind of by design and by definition, internal polling is used as inputs into strategic decision making. You are, in fact, relying on it, and that's why you design it in a particular sort of way. I guess the public is supposed to, in quotes, rely on public polling, but I don't understand why. What difference does it make to me as an individual voter what 48% of the voters polled in some survey think? Why does the public find it interesting? Or something they feel like they need to trust?
It's a snapshot in time of how, you know, the public is feeling towards a particular issue. I think it helps drive how candidates approach their campaigning, how they approach the policies that they decide to make the center of their platforms. It holds candidates accountable. Mm-hmm. If you know that 48% of your constituents don't want to have an extra stoplight added into their town, and you decide to add a stoplight in your town, well, you know, you're going against almost half of what your constituents want. So it's an active reflection that you don't care about what your core demographic is looking for. I think it's good to understand where the pulse of the country is headed. I mean, I think you can look at any of the more recent events, current world events that have happened. You know, no one really thought that the conflicts overseas right now would turn into a very large internal, you know, gut check
right
here in America. And last night in Michigan, we got a clear response that voters right now are saying they're uncommitted to who they want to vote for, even though there's only two choices.
Mm-hmm. Well, don't tell Dean Phillips that.
Oh, Marianne, she was out of the race and she got back into the race.
Oh, Marianne. This actually, I think, brings me back to something I wanted to ask you about at the start, which is that sort of list of, you know, kind of kitchen table or top of mind voter issues. How do you come up with that list? What is the basis for figuring out what to ask people are their top issues?
Well, it's a combination, I think, of the tried and true, right? The things that are just always on voters' minds, and just an awareness of the current events and, you know, what has happened, where things are headed, and what decisions are going to have to be made by government imminently, right, over the next term. It really is an exercise in prioritizing the things that are possibly on voters' minds. But even before we get to that quantitative stage of writing out the issues, we do a lot of qualitative work so that we can kind of hear directly from voters what is on their minds, what is concerning them, what is keeping them up at night, you know, and that feeds into our list, right? Mm-hmm. Something may pop in a focus group that we didn't think to add to the list, and so we'll add it to the list afterwards.
There's also just like a knowledge of current events. Inflation was probably not on the list of priorities, maybe 18, well, let's go back a little bit, 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. I have just recently, in the last 3 months, I started, because of what I was seeing in the news, I split immigration out with border security, because those are two separate issues, but they get merged into one. And now, since both our potential nominees are on the border today, I was kind of right calling it out correctly. Yes. Now a major issue that's going to happen in our campaign. So it's really kind of getting the pulse of what's going on. COVID used to be on that list. It's not anymore. But there's always some basic fundamentals, which are the fundamentals that every human being in America wants. A quality education, quality health care, access to good, affordable housing, gun safety, crime. There's like a low-hanging fruit of all the same things that, you know, across the political aisle, any American could say, I want my kids to be safe.
And pocketbook issues, right?
Yeah, for sure. So this actually does take us into the thing I wanted to ask you about. It is the role of qualitative research. I think the first time I came across Benenson as a name was in, I think, Dan Balz's book about the 2012 election. And it caught my attention because I'm a qualitative researcher. And I was like, oh, digital diaries. Look at that. Like, it's not all Franklin style focus groups or something. Maybe talk a bit about the role of qualitative research and the types of methods that are used, that it's not all sort of standard affinity focus groups, but there's a lot of tools in the toolkit for understanding people's mental models around candidates, parties, issues.
So we call those ethnojournals here. And
it's a better name. It's a better name. After you said it last time.
We're like branding specialists. Like, kind of.
I might borrow it.
It's a very intimate one-on-one process where respondents log into a platform and they respond to a series of multi-layered questions in their own time, in their own space. And it really creates the opportunity to allow respondents to really speak their own truth and not to feel judged. Whereas if you are in a focus group, sometimes you'll see groupthink happen or someone will take over the group and, you know, kind of mold everybody around. This really allows respondents to really feel comfortable and use their own language to explain how they feel about a particular issue. You get to see the values that they bring when they're making decisions about whatever we're asking them about. And again, it really helps to use language. So the example that I use when I try to explain to my friends what I do, because no one understands what we do ever.
No.
I'm like, you know, the way that I talk to you can be regional. If I'm from New York, it's a sneaker. If I go to my cousins out in Ohio, it's a tennis shoe. For them, it's pop. For me, it's soda. There are all these sort of regional dialects that might seem small, but if I'm trying to get someone in the Midwest to really take me seriously and think that I'm authentic and I keep talking about sneakers and soda, they're going to know I'm a New Yorker.
This always makes me think about, you know, when I was doing a lot more kind of in-person focus group and in-person, you know, depth interview work, me and all of my colleagues all had the same kind of, my friend Michelle, I think, called it like this, the moderator as cipher sort of outfit. It's like unbranded, all black clothing, nothing too fancy. You can't tell by looking at me where I'm from, although I suppose the all black does tip someone off a little bit in other parts of the country.
Yes. They're like, no color? New York.
Exactly. But there are also those really interesting sort of techniques of localization that I think is quite interesting. We probably ought to do more of that in our own work. But one of the questions I sometimes get about ethnojournals or just, you know, remote research in general is I think there is kind of hangover points of view of like there's somehow higher quality data when you're physically in person with people versus when something could be unmoderated, not truly unmoderated, but like there's not a live moderator there or it's conducted over a platform like this. I know that that's been kind of evolving over time, both quantitatively and qualitatively in terms of method. How do you think about the differences in the types of data, let's say, that you collect qualitatively, whether it's an ethnojournal or it's an interview or a group?
I think it's not the case that an in-person interaction, even if it's, you know, over video, is always better than an asynchronous approach. It's just not the case. But there are different purposes that each methodology is going to serve best or better than others. The ethnojournals, for instance, are excellent for eliciting really deeply personal responses, particularly about subjects that are inherently, you know, sensitive or just personal, right? So that is a great example of something that if you tried to do the same thing in person, you wouldn't do as well. You wouldn't learn in person the same thing that you can learn through the ethnojournal. So you're limited by time, you're limited by biases, social desirability, and so forth, even if it's a one-on-one interview. And frankly, you know, just some things that people have a difficult time saying out loud to another human being versus being able to write it, you know, with an anonymous feeling to your work. So it's just not always the case that in person is better. But there are also, you know, certainly times when the groupness and that kind of groupthink that Shannon was mentioning is actually desirable, right? And so you want to potentially see how arguments can help people kind of coalesce around an idea in certain instances. In message development, for instance, you want sometimes to see the dynamic between opposing sides, right? And how different arguments of opposing sides could convince an undecided middle, for instance, right? So something like jury groups may be really helpful to a client who wants to message around a really contentious issue and get people off the fence. So a variety of, you know, qualitative approaches are out there, and it's important to understand what the objective is of the learning exercise to determine the right methodology.
Like, I love jury groups, except they are, I don't know, 5-6 hours long. They're like five groups in a row. But if it is just one question, watching the two opposing sides debate and then try to impress a jury panel for one way or the other, and then listening to all three parties discuss, you know, what were the points that made you think yes? What are the points that made you no? But really forcing them to come to one decision, the jury, it's kind of awesome. It's one of my favorite things. That could fundamentally never work online. It's impossible.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, you can certainly do an online focus group. I have to confess, I enjoy moderating focus groups. I know a lot of people are ambivalent about them. I think there's a lot of skill in it, and I think it can be extremely illuminating. I personally don't like doing it online. It's my own sort of feeling of like, I can't see your body language and I'm not sure what's going on right now. Kind of, I need to be a little more tactile.
A little bit more awkward, right?
Sometimes I think I just black out. I'm just like talking things. I'm like, I hope this is recorded in my teeth. I'm like, okay, and another thing. And like afterwards, I'm like, what just happened?
Oh, I may edit this out. I may not. One time I was in London interviewing C-suite folks about enterprise software. And terrible traffic, as usual, in Oxford Circus. And I came running into the facility, was inexplicably named Wyoming. But anyway, running into the facility, plush carpet on the stairs, and you go down a half a flight of stairs to get into the facility. And I, like, caught my heel on the carpet and just went down and sprained my ankle so badly that I had to stay in London and not go on to Frankfurt and, like, rest up before I went on to the next leg of my trip. But I spent the whole rest of the afternoon with my foot up on a chair under a bag of ice interviewing CTOs. And I didn't hear a word. I have no idea what they said. I was very glad they recorded it.
I just read the questions. I was like, okay, next.
Exactly. But, you know, as you're talking about the kind of jury approach, I think that's something that, you know, we don't tend to see that represented in media, right? Like, we might see juries represented in media, but not jury groups. Maybe, sure. Like, describe a little bit how they work.
Sure. So I'll give you an example. I had a client and we wanted to know one simple question is, are you open to reducing sentences for violent offenders? No other context. I didn't tell you how long they've been involved or not. Just, are you open to violent offenders? It starts off with a screener. I have to find my pro side. Then I have to find my con side. But when I'm doing the first group with the pro side, you know, I want to pick a mix of ages, of races, of economic backgrounds, of educational backgrounds, people that maybe are on the fence. They're not pro, they're in the middle. So I can force those people that maybe don't have an opinion. You have to pick a side because I made you the pro side. Same thing with the con side. You know, maybe I pick people that are a little bit more even in between. They're open to criminal justice reform, but maybe not necessarily sentence reduction. Then I have to pick a jury. And the jury, I want really just to be straight up on the fence to a degree, but again, have some type of pro positive support feeling towards reform in general. Mm-hmm. Then I give them, each side gets to go in their own little corners, and I'm like, all right, create an argument. I need everybody to talk. And there used to be an opening. I need you to have, you know, your 5 points, and somebody needs to close both sides. Watching both sides quietly, and you can't really help. I let them use their phones. Mm-hmm. So you can get actual research, and maybe I'll give them a fact sheet of a couple of points. But sometimes that's a little weird because you always have more facts for like why you should decarcerate than you have. Like, it's bad. Right. On the other side. Then they come back and they have, I have a real trial. I set up the room, the jury in the middle, and you know, the pro, the defense, and the plaintiffs, the attorneys on both sides. And, you know, it's an actual trial. Then they go away, the jury deliberates, they come back, and like watching that deliberation process, when again, you just have to say yes or no. You don't get any other caveats here. Mm-hmm. Watching how other people try to, I guess, enforce their will and their opinions on someone that's like categorically against it. Mm-hmm. What usually sways people is storytelling. Mm-hmm. We're like, well, you know, my cousin, they, you know, killed somebody. Yeah. They've been in jail since they were 13. It's been 50 years. Like, it was an accident. It was violent. And then, like, that'll start to move the needle on the one person where they're like, okay, fine. That's the kind of the idea, is to really watch how people break down in their mindset as they're thinking through, like, okay, well, what are the pros and cons? How's this going to impact me? How's this going to impact my community? How's this going to impact families? That's where you get to see the different kind of messages that you can use when you're going into that next phase of research,
exactly,
in the quant, where I'm like, okay, telling a story about my so-and-so will make me be more open to sentence reduction, or giving you facts about things that have happened in the last year will make you more open to it. So,
what's worth taking?
Six hours.
Six hours is a long time. We used to do these, not the same, but they would be like 3-hour creative workshops. And we would frequently, we called them super groups. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you'd have 15 people in there instead of six. And they would split up into groups, and they might have to, you know, come up with a concept over here, come up with a concept over here, pitch each other and get feedback and questions and that kind of thing. I always loved those. And watching you, Shannon, describe the jury groups, I can see that you love them, even though they're 5 hours long.
Jury groups that we conduct are really similar, actually, to the mock juries that are conducted for litigation, right? Yeah. Having also done litigation research prior to BSG, you know, that qualitative research was set up quite similarly, although truer to, you know, the actual case that we were testing. But the thing that made it so effective was, you know, being able to, like Shannon said, really understand what were the specific facts and arguments, right, that actually drove the decision making in the deliberation. Watching the deliberation happen, just watching that conversation among the jury, it's so illuminating.
Yeah.
And really fabulous.
Well, and it's such an interesting approach. You know, I think the thing I always like about qualitative research is that I get to kind of witness people going through the cognitive process, whether that's emotionally driven or rationally driven. I don't care. But like, it's all interesting. Some things are more rationally driven. Some things are more emotionally driven. Some things are extremely social. But being able to kind of observe that, to stand in witness of that, is incredibly illuminating for then figuring out not just what types of questions to ask, but also how to phrase them, how to order them, so that you're not suddenly throwing people off of the way they personally puzzle through things, which can have an effect. I think all three of us would violently agree. Qualitative is essential to writing a really good survey instrument. But once you get to that stage of things, talk a bit about what makes a good quality survey. And I think that, once again, in parallel to the story you just told, Shannon, it starts with the screener. But maybe kind of step through some of the things you guys think about in terms of what makes for a good survey design.
So first of all, precise language is really essential. You don't want to really leave anything open to interpretation, because if you do, you just don't know the significance of the data that you're collecting. If three respondents could interpret a question three different ways, then that question really at the end of the day is not useful to you. And you're not measuring what you think you're measuring. The question order is also extremely important. The way that a question is asked in terms of the language, yes, is important, but it also matters what questions came before it. The way that questions are arranged in terms of their ordering is really important because there's always bias. Every question that you're exposed to can and will bias your responses to the questions that follow. And so, you know, you need to consider the objectives of the work, how that bias is likely to work in the survey, and, you know, is it something that you're comfortable with, or do you have to edit to address that?
Yeah, you want to build from simple to more complex. Mm-hmm. You know, if I was, again, we'll use violent offenders as an example, that would not be the first, within the first five questions.
Right.
Yeah. You know, like, let me know a little bit more about you. I want to know if you feel safe in your community. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask questions about, do you think crime is rising or falling or decreasing before I start saying, how do you feel about reform? You got to really layer people up, because if you put the questions kind of out of order, you can bias the rest of your survey because people will be like, oh, I know what this survey is about. They're trying to get me to do that. And they're like, I got to make you feel like, well, don't you want to know about dessert?
I think as simple as, you know, how you ask the gender question. Shannon, you talked about this last time we were discussing the options that you include in your gender question can give away who's asking the question, who's conducting the poll, right? So if you have male, female, if you have man, woman, non-binary, other, you know,
transgendered, and I'm giving this poll in Wichita, I'm going to lose probably the conservatives that I wanted to respond to it because they're like, this liberal pollster here.
Right.
And then, like, when we go back, we can tell when we're waiting that we're underrepresenting a large demographic because we wrote the poll wrong.
In a certain way. Right, exactly. So you want to think about, do I need to ask gender first here? What options do I need to include at this gender question in this poll? And those are the kinds of considerations in the real world that you have to make.
Yeah, the demographic questions are so interesting. And we, unless it's a reason to screen people out, we tend to leave all of those to the end. And the most polarizing questions are the last ones. So we've already got your answers to all the other questions before we get to that. But it's also been really interesting. A relatively accepted practice over time has become to ask, for instance, racial and ethnic identity, also in a kind of two-parter. So, you know, taking Hispanic as its own question and then having a second question about, you know, racial and ethnic identities and allowing people to multi-select because it's, you know, it's America. It's the reality. And then also letting people have a prefer to self-describe line, which is a thing we've started to do. And it's fascinating because depending on the project, we will occasionally get people who want to argue with us in the open end about whether they are, and I'll just be clear about this, it's always the same argument. It's whether it's white or Caucasian.
Interesting.
There are some people who feel very strongly that they are Caucasian and they want that word. And then other people feel very strongly that Caucasian is not a thing and that they are white. And I don't know, you know, who knows what's going on there, but it is a thing we have seen over time. And so we have moved those questions to the back of the screener because for our work, we're almost never screening on racial identities. But we want to know, we want to have a representative sample, but we can sort that out at the end of the survey instead of at the beginning. Are there other things that you think about? You know, we do a lot of, you know, masked recruiting where it's unclear who the client is, just to prevent, you know, I don't know, fanboys and fangirls from hopping in or people who really hate it from hopping in.
Well, and biased
again, right?
And biasing it again. And so how do you guys approach that? I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of things you consider about giving away region, party, et cetera, too early in the process.
Most of our studies are blinded. There are very few instances where we will reveal who is paying for the work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, typically we are only doing that if we are positive that there's a good reason to do so, such as, you know, we won't get people to respond otherwise, or, you know, this is a very finite audience. If it's a client, you know, customer survey, something of that nature. But the vast majority of the time, it is a blinded survey and, you know, it's BSG doing the survey and doing the research. And we don't reveal typically who the client is.
Mm-hmm. So one of the other things we talked about last time that as I'm thinking about screening and also thinking a little bit about your comment about Michigan and uncommitteds is also undecideds, which is something I think last time we spoke, Natalie, you pointed out that there's just not a lot done, certainly in the public polling, to understand the undecided voter. And maybe you could talk a little bit about how you think about undecideds, how, you know, if you were to give them advice on how to try to understand undecideds in their public polling, what would be the things you'd want to know in this role as a kind of consumer of public polling?
Well, I mean, in the public polling, there are a couple of things that I think are really interesting. The undecideds and the people who say that they just aren't going to vote, right? I think there are two separate issues there. One is, okay, if they're not going to vote, I don't care what they think in this poll. That's not helping me, right?
Right.
They're not going to affect the outcome. So it doesn't make sense to include them in the poll to begin with. But many, many, maybe the majority of public polls do include those folks that say, I didn't vote last time, I'm not going to vote this time. And it's usually about 20% of the sample, which makes sense because about 80% of the public at most is going to go vote. So just that in and of itself is a dead giveaway. Like, take these results with a grain of salt, right? Then when you get into the undecideds, you know, we as pollsters do pay attention to those undecideds. We do want to understand in our research what makes them tick. What do they care about? What issues kind of rise to the top for them? What messaging resonates with them most, et cetera? Mm-hmm. And how are they trending over time? I think we just don't see that in the public polling and what's available in the public sphere, probably for more financial reasons than anything else. It's just expensive to do that kind of focused research and targeted analysis. It's time consuming and it requires some, you know, expertise and additional thought. And it's just not always worth it for the media outlets who are commissioning these public polls to make that expenditure. They're not trying to get the undecided voters to vote for anyone, right? They're just trying to get a sense of, you know, where are people going over time? And as that undecided portion shrinks, right, what does the horse race look like? But the horse race isn't the only thing that matters. And that's something that we also take a lot of consideration around as we're doing research.
The horse race drives me crazy, and I think all media outlets should never be allowed to report on it, like, ever again. Or at least, like, maybe the last, like, 30 days, I don't want to hear about it.
Right.
Yeah. Because they don't take into consideration. No voter knows what the margin of error is. It's plus or minus this direction or that direction. So if I'm saying it is a, you know, plus or minus 4 points, that can be a big difference. I throw in undecided voters on top of that. Now we're really talking about a big spread that's possible that no media outlet is going to take the time or energy to explain in their 2-minute segment.
Yeah.
They just want to give you that top headline. The other thing about undecided voters is, to a degree, they might actually be undecided, you know, in 2016, 2020, when there were, you know, 16 people on stage vying to be the candidate. You should probably still be undecided at this point because there's 5 other options.
Right.
There's not 5 other options today. Mm-hmm. We know who our options are going to be. And this uncommitted, undecided vote could be they're genuinely undecided or unhappy about the current situation. Or there's also a little bit of a reluctance to lie to pollsters. Mm-hmm. You don't want tell who you're going to vote for because you think we're good. You can surprise us on election day.
Yep.
But it does mess with the accuracy of polling. And I think what we learned last night in Michigan, that this undecided, uncommitted voter is now like our third party candidate.
Right.
How long do you want to play chicken?
Right. Right,
with that because group. It does impact campaign strategy. It impacts media buys. Where am I supposed to be spending my money in these last couple of days? Well, if I've got a bunch of people in Michigan that are still saying that they're undecided, and I put a bunch of money into that campaign, knowing good and well that that state has a trifecta of Democrats in their state legislature, that they're probably going to vote one way and not the other.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I should be spending my money in Arizona. So the undecided voters become the latest bane of my existence.
Oh, I bet. That's interesting because undecided, I would imagine, is like a basket of types. You know, that there are people who are undecided because they have not paid any attention to the thing and aren't even really sure who's running. And so I don't know. And that is also a thing I sometimes see in public polling is undecided and don't know both being offered. Yeah. And it's kind of like, that's interesting. That actually might be helpful to split them out. Like, I don't know can be its own group. And undecided is like, no, I know who's in it. I just haven't picked anybody yet. But the not picking anybody yet, I think, is so amorphous that it contains people who are effectively like withholding their commitment because they want to make a point, or they are really leaning one way, but they don't want to admit it yet. Or like the thing they're actually undecided about is whether they're going to vote at all. And like, I'm just not sure if it matters enough to me this year. Or I'm not sure if it's worth it or whatever. And without, you know, some of the other work that you guys do, like there's just no way of knowing what's contained within that group of people. And then I think that margin of error is doing a lot of work for a lot of pundits. But right. If they're not taking into account the 10, 12, 15% of undecideds, I mean, that number always gets a little smaller as we get closer to the election. And I think maybe that's part of it. They don't take it seriously because they have taken it as an article of faith that the closer we get to the election, the fewer people say they are undecided. But there's still quite a few undecideds at the end of a campaign who kind of surprise break one way or the other. And it seems like that just doesn't get captured, certainly in public polling. I imagine it's a challenge even in internal polls to figure out how you want to diagnose the undecideds. Is that something that you endeavor to do, especially as you get closer to the end where those undecideds might make or break in a particular state or in a particular race?
You can kind of gauge by some of the other questions that you ask. Right? Mm-hmm. I can tell you might be undecided today, but you voted in 18, you voted in 22, mm-hmm. you voted in midterm elections, I'm going to guess you're going to vote in this presidential.
Right.
So like, I can look at your voter file and be like, okay, you voted every single time. You're even voting in school board elections. Mm-hmm. Right? I can say you're undecided today, but I'm pretty sure you're just saying that because you're mad about something. That's okay.
That's totally okay.
But you're clearly going to vote.
Right.
Now, if I see things, I actually just had a client ask me about unlikely voters, and I was like, but why? Mm-hmm. But just to see if a particular issue could move an unlikely voter to a likely voter.
Right. Yeah.
But like, was it worth going into those nuances? Probably not that much.
Yeah.
But there were some differences in the response.
That's an interesting one, because I think there has been this story that, you know, one of the secrets to Trump's success in 2016 was turning unlikely voters into likely voters. And I haven't done enough of a dive to know whether I think that's really what was going on there, or if they were just sort of infrequent voters becoming committed to actually voting in that cycle, or net new voters, people who hadn't registered before. But I feel like that is a thing I see a lot about is the, well, you know, it's the unlikelies that you got to figure out because they'll surprise you every time. You can't model them. But, you know, in terms of like planning the use of resources, it makes sense to kind of deprioritize people who say, I'm just not going to vote. You know, all right, that's all we need to know. Because in the final count, we're not going to do a tally up of Biden Trump didn't vote. The didn't vote group doesn't get
that's
any electors. Exactly.
Yeah.
As we wrap up, I'm just curious if you have any other, this is sort of a question I've asked everyone I've interviewed up to this point. Any other pet peeves about the public discourse around polling that you'd like to get off your chest?
What bothers me about the public polling is kind of a lack of transparency. You know, when we are issuing public memos, you know, with results to polling that is going public, we always attach a fulsome top line that has all of the data for all of the questions were asked, but for anything proprietary, right? Anything protected by confidentiality, ownership types of things. The vast majority of the poll is public, right? And publicly available. We don't make any effort to hide anything, and we describe in some detail the methodology that we use to collect that data. The same is not true of public polls. You have to dig for that information. And when you find it, you know, I find often, even in a set of crosstabs where I can see how men voted, women voted, I can see how different party IDs voted. I can see how different ethnicities voted. You don't see the responses to those banners in the crosstabs in the tables. I can't see the data for the questions. Okay, I can see how Democrats responded to the other questions. I can see how Republicans responded to the other questions. But I can't see how many Democrats and Republicans you have in your poll. I can't see if your sample is balanced. I can't see if this poll is worth paying any attention to or if this is completely unrepresentative. And that feels to me very disingenuous and misleading, even if it's not. Even if it was a well-balanced poll, I don't know that. And so I'm making the assumption that something is being hidden. That's me as a consumer of polling. But I think, you know, certainly the average person isn't exactly that same way. They do take it at face value.
I can't stand the cherry picking of data.
Yeah.
Yes.
Very easy for especially media outlets and journals to look at research really quickly and create their own little story that fits the narrative that they want their segment to say. And, you know, if we're going to say that the country is right track, wrong track, and we're talking on, you know, a conservative news platform, well, then I'm going to really lead into, you know, 74% of the country say it's on the wrong track.
Yeah.
Well, if I look at that 74%, guess who's driving that number? It's not Democrats, it's not independents. It's actually being driven by Republicans. And so the ability to kind of pick pieces. Now, is it wrong? No. But you're not telling the full story. You're misrepresenting the rest of the data that there. Sometimes there's an outlier as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just ignore the outlier because it doesn't make the rest of the data make sense. Well, there's a reason there's an outlier. Either your reading is wrong, sampling it wrong, or it just doesn't fit the headlines. So you just decided to talk about it.
Right. Yeah, I think that's that one is, well, all of those are things that drive me nuts. But there's also that covering multiple questions, sometimes multiple questions across multiple surveys, which also drives me a little nuts because they're now you're comparing lots of different things that are not that similar. But also the, you know, on this question, we like the story that we get if we take top two box. On this question, we like the story if we only take, you know, the furthest end of the scale. And then there are even more egregious ones where it's like, we're going to take the neutral position and just roll it into the positive position because that's what we want to tell the story about.
It's not negative.
Right. Technically not negative. We literally just had this conversation with a client the other day about kind of somewhat interested as a statement in the scale. And they wanted to include the somewhat interested. And I was like, no, because in this context, somewhat means not really very at all.
Yeah. Right.
And so they're not going to have anything to say about this. And we went back and forth on it. And the thing I wound up doing, in all honesty, was saying, you can keep it because I know they will screen out some other way. Like, I know that they will reveal themselves to be totally disinterested in this category later on. I have other questions that will reveal this to me. But that kind of cherry picking is, I think, extremely frustrating. And I think one of the problems is because they're not transparent about any of those things, base sizes, margin of error, like structure of the question. Sometimes it's hard to get, like, you'll get the bar chart that gives you the result, but you can't get the question. Like, like at least on, you know, TV is more typical for doing that sort of thing where it's like, I don't know what you ask them. They said that they feel this way, but what was the question? All of that kind of lack of transparency, I think, does make it feel like, well, you can get a poll to say anything. Even if that's not what the actual pollster did, they were doing their best with the resources they had. The way that it then gets presented to us all is not particularly confidence inspiring. And if you know a little, it gets really dangerous. I mean, you definitely have, you know, Redditors out there who would have you believe that no survey with fewer than 1,000 respondents is representative. And, you know, all of those guys think they know what statistical significance means, but they don't. You know, those kinds of things happen all the time as well. If you were to give some advice then to an average person watching coverage of public polling, what would you advise them to do in order to kind of keep their head on straight? I get too worked up one way or the other. Ignore the polls is a favorite one, but I don't know if you have something else that you would offer as a way to encounter polls in a more meaningful way.
Yeah, I do your due diligence, right? Like, click on the link. Look for the top line. Look for the link to the data. See what you can see in that data that tells you who took the poll, right? And if you cannot find, you know, a layout of the gender, age, party ID, and region from which people were responding, then maybe don't put too much faith in that poll.
Yeah.
Consider the source, where it's coming from. Mm-hmm. You know, these media outlets, they are getting paid for the clickbait, and they are going to want to give the best clickbait to who they know is watching.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And just to be mindful of that, if I am on CNN and I'm telling you that, like, you know, Republicans are horrible, and you look down and it says based on a survey with 1,000 Democrats, well, you're like, okay, I saw what you did.
Right. Right. Yeah.
I think your average voter isn't going to really have time to, like, think about the crosstabs. I mean, that's what we mm-hmm. first immediately go to.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so just check your sources. Try more than one place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not everyone is. If you can find the sort of same topic across multiple platforms in the same range, then that's probably what the true American sentiment is right now.
Mm-hmm.
If this poll is the only one that's saying this and you can't find anywhere else, there's probably something cherry-picked or wrong about the survey, and it's really there just to get eyeballs and views.
Yeah.
Right. If something seems wrong, it probably is.
Probably is.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's nothing quite like horse sense, right? Like, there's just sort of a certain kind of, it doesn't pass the smell test. And I think that's when you're in awash in all the information that we are awash in these days, and when trust is low in general for media sources. I think it operates in really strange ways. Like, trust is low, but I believe everything I see is a thing that you can have both of those feelings at the same time. And so it's a question I continue to wrestle with, which is, I don't know why you would, as an ordinary voter, want to, quote unquote, rely on a poll. It's interesting if you're someone more likely to be activated, like, oh, maybe I should get activated so I can turn something around. Or I suppose the other thing is there's some sort of bandwagon effect of, like, this candidate looks like it's the most successful one, so I'm going to get on board with that one because it looks like everyone else thinks they're going to win. And so, you know, pick the winning horse kind of a move. But apart from that, like, the, well, you can't trust the polls kind of narrative seems to be really out there. And I just keep wondering why people feel like they need to trust the polls as opposed to just finding them interesting. Like, unless you're going to personally do something with them, I don't know why it matters so much. I say, as someone who makes her living doing research, but nevertheless, I really appreciate you both taking the time to talk through all of this with me. And I hope we get to do it again.
We'd love to.
I was like, let's talk trauma in November, December, yeah?
Yes. So let's do a debrief. Okay.
Oh, my gosh. I don't know if I might not make it that long.
Crosstabs is hosted by me, Farah Bostic, with Paul Saldera. Production by The Difference Engine and edited by me. Music from Audio Jungle by S Audio. Find us at crosstabspodcast.com, where you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter and find out immediately when new episodes drop. Tell your friends about the show, subscribe on your favorite podcast service, drop us a note if you have any questions about poll design or sampling or weighting or anything else, and we'll see you next time.